It's the Paranormal Yoga edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, swinging babies, gay marriage, HIV evolution, and a paranormal interview with Ben Redford. Let's start episode 121.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
Joining you again is Jenna, your biochemist.
Excellent.
And soon to be doctor.
Soon to be doctor. Oh, someday.
That's good, because I got this pain in my back that's sort of, you know. Just
that's great, because I am exactly that type of doctor. Ooh.
Can you write prescriptions?
Tons. You're a bacteria, I got you covered.
Excellent. This is working out really well.
Yeah, so anyone listening, if you notice our future episodes seem a tad, I don't know, psychedelic, understand that we now have someone who can write us prescription meds just for the show, just to relieve the stress, take the edge off.
Yeah. Well, speaking of taking the edge off, Don.
Exactly. You know, people who are followers of things Americana or whatever will have heard recently that the United States Supreme Court heard our episode about violent video games and rendered a decision that actually, I think, kind of went with what we were talking about. In California, there is a ban on minors buying violent video games, right? And they have a certain rating system to do that. And this was deemed to be unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court majority decision by Scalia said that the video games have an absolute First Amendment right to free speech, which included the graphic depiction of violence, that children were in no way exempt from this, that we can't, and I think I'm quoting here, deny the children to be exposed to new and different ideas, which I guess killing people is a new idea and quite different in our history.
You know, I noticed a really interesting quote where he said that something like along the lines of reading Dante is a great expression of cultural identity. Playing video games might not be on that level, but regardless of that difference of cultural value, it's not a Supreme Court issue. They can't legislate what is a good expression of culture. And therefore, maybe they don't like video games, maybe they think it's a waste of time, but they can't make it illegal for other people to enjoy video games.
What I thought was interesting was there was actually sort of two dissenting opinions on this. One was by the renowned conservative and kickback king, Justice Clarence Thomas, and that you have to be in American politics to know what I mean by that. But he sat there and he actually opposed this idea, not because he thought that the First Amendment right was important or not, because he is a literalist as far as the Constitution goes, but he thought that children were essentially controlled and owned by your parents, and that the parents had an absolute right to limit whatever the children saw, and that you could buy these violent video games for your children if you wanted to, but the children themselves didn't have that right. It was only through the parent that you could exercise this. The other dissenting one was by Stephen Breyer. And he made a very interesting comment, which perhaps has a bit of hyperbole, maybe not, but he points out that this creates a irreconcilable contradiction between previous rulings by the Supreme Court, in which they said that pornography was bad for society and doesn't have the full protection of the First Amendment. And he pointed out, and he said, and I think I'm quoting here, paper says I'm quoting, "What sense does it make to forbid selling a 13-year-old boy a magazine with an image of a nude woman while protecting the sale to that 13-year-old of an interactive game in which he actively, but virtually, binds, gags, and then tortures to death the woman?" He says how can a boob, right, scar someone for life, yet the evisceration of someone from the inside out be like, eh, I saw that in the news, not big.
Yeah, that does ring a few skeptical bells for me, because A, that sounds like a false dichotomy, and two, I'm skeptical that you can even do that in a video game. Now, maybe I'm wrong, I haven't played every video game, but I've never heard of that before. I have heard of ultra-violent video games like Mortal Kombat and such, but to me, they're so beyond the realm of realism that it's almost like getting worked up over a Bugs Bunny cartoon where Bugs Bunny flattens somebody's head with a mallet and then they walk around like a little pancake or something.
Well, yes, and to be pedantic, your point is correct. But I think what he's trying to say is that if you had the same, very same video game, right, in which you had a nude woman wandering around on a nudist beach, that would be banned, or could be banned, because it's pornographic. Whereas if you had that same video game and the person in there was, again, being killed in whatever way, Mortal Kombat-ish or not, I think Infamous has set a new bar as far as graphic violence goes for killing people, but that would be all right to sell, but you couldn't sell the nudist beach. And they're saying that just it doesn't smell right. Jenna, do you have an opinion on this issue?
Well, call me a biologist, Don, but my mind always springs to evolution. And it always makes me think of how our laws and the ways in which we decide to govern ourselves, and especially our children, are always evolving. So, I mean, I think it's fair to say that most of the absolute lines that are drawn, you know, versus, you know, nipple versus just, you know, really egregious cleavage and killing versus, you know, just a slight slap on the face in these type of entertainment issues are relatively arbitrary. And you have to draw the line somewhere. So I think people tend to get really up in arms when they see these dichotomies, as you were saying, just because there's really no way to draw a line so that you're not going to find those. And you can't have a law without a line.
That's true. Well, speaking of crossing a line, Don, surely nowhere in the video games are you going to see babies swinging around, right?
Well, you know, actually, when I first heard this, right, and I heard that the video was banned from YouTube, and I kind of assumed it was banned because, well, there are naked babies on there, and the United States, at least, has a huge sort of thing about child pornography, and I don't want to get into that discussion, but I thought, oh, the worst thing they saw on this was naked babies. But if you saw it, and I must admit, when I first saw it, I mean, I was shocked, I was stunned, I was disturbed. It's a video, well, actually, there are several videos out there showing a parent throwing a baby around, much like a kung fu master would be throwing around a set of nunchucks. And it's called, apparently, baby swing yoga. Now, of course, my knee-jerk reaction to this was horror, right? And, like, it must be stopped. It just, when you see it, it just somehow seems so very, very wrong. Then I thought, well, okay, let's take a step back. Let's take a skeptical look at it and just, you know, see what's going on. So first I should point out that this practice, apparently, has been going on for decades, at least in Russia. That's what the articles I've read have claimed. And that at least one generation has reached relative adulthood without any serious damage, any damage evident, and have good lives as free divers, which apparently are people who don't use scuba gear and they dive down into the ocean to, I don't know, pick up pearls or
real deep.
Yeah. Literally. Now, the one thing I'm going to point out, that the age apparently of the person in the video, they say that starting this yoga practice is 5 days old, which I'll get to later. So I thought I'd go down sort of a skeptical checklist, and the thing that I thought was most sort of equivalent to this would be chiropractic. Now, not to kick on chiropractic, but chiropractic involves manipulation of young children where there's a certain fear that this is not a good thing. And I thought, well, you know, part of the sort of body manipulation that chiropractic claims to do is it's got a weak claim that this just helps align the bones and relieves pain and that sort of thing. They make a much stronger claim, or weaker, depending on how you have it, in which case, of course, you know, they're supposed to cure conditions like asthma, chronic ear infections, colic, bedwetting. So there's the claim issue, right? Strong and weak claims. And then, of course, there's also literally the potential damage. That the movements that chiropractors do are snapping, jerking motions, which have in the past shown to be actually quite damaging to the body.
Causing strokes and stuff.
Exactly. So I thought, okay, let's take these sort of three issues and apply it to this baby swing yoga. Now, the actual healthcare claims made by the baby swing are actually very modest, right? They do make the, you know, the if you do this child, they'll be smarter, quicker, they'll walk faster, sort of amorphous general things. But the only real, you know, hardcore claims they kind of make is that the child will have a healthy enjoyment of floating free in three-dimensional space. That this is just sort of a developmental exercise, that they're not making any claim that if you put your child through this that they'll learn to fly, that it will cure any form of cancer. So their claims, both weak and strong, are rather innocuous. And I must admit, you know, I couldn't quite see any big issues with their claim. Now, of course, as I say, you know, the person who is doing this, who is a paid, quote, child-rearing expert, says, you know, a lot of things in the video, right? Which, of course, comes close to woo, right? I mean, like I say, it helps with the, you know, contentment, and they'll be happier, and their spirits will be free and all that. And so they were getting close to it, but it wasn't sort of that horrible in that regards. So the claim-wise, I don't know, I can't make a big issue as far as what they claim. But with regards to, does it actually cause any physical damage? Well, if you look at the actual video, and I must admit, I am not an expert here, and I am quite willing to be corrected by someone who is a registered doctor, an actual, what do you call someone who's a body doctor for bones?
An osteotician?
Something like that. you know, I will trust their judgment more, but from the research I did, no one seemed to have too much of an issue, because the motions that she was doing were very fluid. They were very gentle in what she was doing. You know, at no point were there any jerking movements. At no point did the child seem to be in discomfort. Actually, the child mostly seemed sort of, this is just the way things are going. Some of the videos say that the children are laughing and all that. I didn't see any laughing children, but I did hear a few people watching it go, you know, as far as the actual physical damage to the child itself, the actions itself seem to be okay. Now, of course, there's a very important caveat to this. This is a trained person, apparently. This is well-trained. And one of the fears, and one of the actual apparent reason that they took the video down from YouTube is the fact that they're worried about amateurs imitating this. So they're worried about, I don't know, some guy named Bubba or John or his wife, trailer park trash, I'm just going to go out there and go for it. Hands greasy with fried chicken or whatever, saying, hey, that's good for my kid, I'm going to try that, and start whipping the child around, and pretty soon you see it fly out the window because it just slipped out of their hand or something, right? Because we all know people will see things on the internet and say, hey, that's cool, I'm going to do it too. We live in a culture of people who like to mimic. So there's a fear that this is going to cause a bunch of people imitating this, and they won't do it properly. They will have jerk motions, and that will cause all sorts of badness. So in that sense, I guess it's bad. In fact, the only thing I really, really found disturbing on this, not that I'm the only one in this room, because Jenna's about to jump down my throat, is the fact that this exercise apparently was started at 5 days old. And to me, that just seems innately way too early to begin something like this. I mean, you know, one, you don't know enough about the child. I mean, 5 days old, maybe there's some congenital issues or maybe something. There didn't seem to be any reason just to be a little prudent and maybe start it at 1 year old, right? I know that's just as an arbitrary date as anything else. But I mean, you know, I mean, if you're going to do something like this, I mean, I don't know, it seemed to be way too early, even if that. That being said, just because you can do something obviously means there's a good reason to do it. Just like putting your child into a car. I mean, we know we have car accidents every day, and yet we insist on taking our children around with us. Why do we do that? That's a horrible risk. Jenna, what do you think about the horrible risks we put our children to every day? Like throwing a child up to hear it go, wee!
So I'm just sitting here killing myself laughing of your use of the word prudent.
Yeah, okay. No, and I agree. This is a relativistic term in this sense.
Well, and as you were going through sort of the issues that you found with this practice, I found myself thinking of some analogies, and absolutely with the last point you made there of, you know, just because you can and just because it doesn't hurt, I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you can make a lot of fairly well-reasoned arguments about decent reasons and sort of consequences of doing certain practices. So, for example, you could make the argument that by a mother holding just really delicately a cleaver above her newborn, that, you know, that might engender some trust in the baby for the mother because, you know, time after time, they realize that they wouldn't get hurt and this would be a good thing for the baby to understand that they can trust the ones they love. I still am not sure that that's a super good plan. What I really want to know, you know, I definitely was not swung as a child, especially as a five-day-old child. I might have, you know, had some little arm swinging, you know, at the park as I got older. But I feel, you know, fairly comfortable in the world. I feel fairly oriented on my two feet that I have, you know, come to walk on over
Don't
the course
feel
of my
kind
development.
Of anxiety in three-dimensional space or anything?
Well, you see,
yeah, well, I exhibit, you know, you might not think just because it's a voice over the radio that I actually do occupy three dimensions, but I am telling you, we are sitting here in a cube which is fully three-dimensional talking to you, and I do not feel any anxiety at all. So I'm really wondering, although, you know, as you were saying, the practice in itself, I'm not sure, causes a lot of damage right now as is practiced, but even more than your chicken-fingered trailer trash swinging their babies.
And my apologies to anyone who may have took offense to that. It was intended to be more comedic than anything else.
I'm worrying about the kind of regulatory bodies that might, you know, have to develop for this type of practice, because more than that, I would worry about the more far-reaching consequences of basically quacks setting up practice and charging parents a lot of money to perform this exercise technique on their newborns, perhaps not as skilled as the woman we saw in the video.
I think I would agree with that last part. Although, as someone who suffers from a fear of heights, perhaps as a child, my mother holding me over a five-story building just to let me enjoy it might have actually allowed me to not have a fear of heights.
So you want to be Michael Jackson's kid.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Although, that being said, I mean, I think when you use the cleaver is a bit of a misanalogy, because children do like to explore the feelings of rush you get from floating. I mean, swings. The whole point of a swing is to feel the rush of gravity.
Heck, adults like it too. That's where roller coasters come in.
Exactly. So it's slightly misanalogy. But your point, I think your last point is the strongest. That the video was itself disturbing, but the most disturbing thing is where it may lead to from here. And I think we both agree that with a good, proper government, proper regulations, things like this will hopefully never be allowed to be taken too far, like it has for some issues. Speaking of chiropractic, Ethan, do you have any comments about this?
No, I don't. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker. I'll be back with more after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. You know, back in 1984, Margaret Heckler of the Secretary of Health of Human Services in the U.S. said, "The discovery of HIV enables us to develop a vaccine and prevent AIDS in the future. We hope to have such a vaccine ready for testing in approximately 2 years. Well, that didn't happen. Turns out that's pretty hard to do, actually, create a vaccine for HIV. But there's a new study that might lead us to the elusive cure. And understanding evolution is our key to finding it. The reason we haven't been able to create a vaccine for HIV is that the virus is extremely good at evolving. HIV can produce around 100 billion new virus particles every day. And it does so with the unusual imprecision, meaning that most genetic material is copied, tries to make an exact copy of itself. But HIV does a different approach. They create errors. And this causes a very difficult process for scientists and doctors, in that the virus is very good at eluding vaccines or drug treatments. And in the face of this sort of rapid shape-shifting, our medical attempts to cure the virus have ultimately failed. So scientists have been looking for parts of HIV's proteins that tend to stay the same. Areas that do so are considered conserved sites and tend to be important in some way. Mutating them would compromise the virus's ability to reproduce. By training the immune system to attack these sites, we would give the virus an unenviable choice: do nothing and die, or change and become weaker. However, the virus could alter a different part of its protein so to make these conserved sites no longer important, so they could again avoid drugs or treatment. Well, a couple of researchers, Vincent Tahira and Catherine Sekar from MIT, I'm probably saying their names wrong, I apologize, have come up with a different approach. They want to identify large groups of conserved sites on HIV proteins, which they call HIV sectors. And these aren't just, these are sites that stay the same en masse, and the rest of the virus changes around them. So the idea is to train the immune system to attack all these sites of a sector to escape the ability of HIV to mutate its way out of trouble. So in effect, HIV would not be able to change enough of itself without actually compromising its ability to reproduce. So this is an interesting new idea, and it comes from a theory called random matrix theory, which detects groups of objects that change in a concerted way. And it actually has its origins in high-energy physics, and economists themselves have been using this to study fluctuating stock prices. So it's a very interesting way of approaching HIV. So for the virus itself, they're focusing on an area called GAG, the proteins that make up HIV's outer coat. They've identified five sectors in GAG, particularly sector 3, which is considerably restrained. New mutagens are quite rare there, so sector 3 sites are very important for finding ways to attack the virus. Without them, the virus wouldn't be able to assemble its outer shell and would be extremely weakened. So if we target sector 3 of GAG, we may have a way to herd HIV into an evolutionary dead end. Now, of course, I'm not really an expert on viruses, but Jenna?
Well, I'm not an expert on viruses per se, but I can definitely talk to the idea of mutations and the way that the virus can evade the immune system. So as you were saying, you know, it's able to change. But the point that I'd really like to drive home about that is that the mutations that are happening, first off, they're definitely not premeditated. We're talking about a virus here, which is the random, pretty much singular events, which is why you need to come up with so many thousands and millions of virus particles to find one that is beneficial. And not only are they sort of not premeditated to be beneficial, but usually it does end up handicapping the virus in some way, but it's sort of the cost is outweighed by the benefits to the virus. So for example, when we're talking about a vaccine development, what a vaccine does is it teaches your immune system to recognize a part of a dangerous thing like a virus so that the next time it sees it, it can attack it really effectively. So it needs to be able to recognize it. So it's for an analogy with this, with HIV, for example, if you taught it to recognize the hand so that the hand was handcuffed, the virus might mutate by cutting off its hand. So it doesn't have a hand anymore, but it can't be caught by the immune system. And although it's causing it some sort of detriment, and all these mutations really are very straining on the virus, in the end, it's coming out on top because it's able to replicate overall. However, as I said before, these mutation events are singular events. You usually end up with just sort of one mutation at a time. So the idea of this study and this type of approach is to look at things where you'd need a whole bunch of mutations at the same time for the virus to be able to compensate for the loss or sort of the compromisation of one of what the the immune system is trying to attack. So that number of mutations happening at the same time is such an incredibly low probability event that the virus can't really cope with that. And you end up, like you said, sort of backing it into a corner.
But HIV is sort of unique in sort of the virus world in that it's exceptionally good at making copies of itself and putting out all these different sort of strains of itself. So it does kind of represent a different challenge. I mean, that's why we haven't been able to beat HIV in this way in the past, right?
Well, absolutely. And if you think of it, it's like a different lifestyle, I'm going to say choice to anthropomorphize, but clearly, you know, it's just a different evolutionary strategy that this virus is taking compared to something that copies its DNA with more precision. It's like saying I'm going to be a sea-dwelling thing as opposed to a land-dwelling thing. It's just a different life choice. So there are both benefits and detriments to that. So the detriments are that because the DNA is being copied with so many errors, tons of those virus particles are going to be totally inviable. They're just going to be, dead if a virus can be dead. Won't be able to replicate. But you get the odd one that really helps it beat the curve and beat the immune system and beat our scientific efforts to try and come up with a vaccine.
So hasn't this actually sort of already been tried? Because I thought one of the things about the drug cocktail that is the current treatment is to, again, have this sort of multi-pronged attack on the virus itself. You know, and some of the things that Ethan had mentioned in this article, you know, said, well, rarely do these things mutate. But one of the reasons why we have resistant bacteria now is that, you know, we got rid of most of them, but one or two managed to survive, and you've now sort of left the ecosystem open and free for these rare ones, which wouldn't normally have a chance to repopulate, to sort of take over, right? And thirdly, just to slam on it.
Just to confuse me with your questions?
Well, you know, I thought one of the big issues too with this is because HIV actually attacks the immune system itself, it's sort of attacking the one thing that's sort of trained to try and get rid of it, and once it sort of overpowers that, there's no longer a line of defense to use.
Absolutely. So there is a feedback loop in HIV that definitely your last point plays into, but that doesn't really have that much to do with these therapies because we don't have much else to fight it with than our immune system, so we're gonna stick with that as our go-to guy. But as far as your first point, or your second point, I don't remember at this point. But you're absolutely right that multi-drug therapy is to attack different parts of the virus. And also when it's used for bacteria, it's really common in tuberculosis and that kind of thing. It's all the same concept. Firstly, yes, you're attacking different components of it so that you're hoping to be really effective at killing it or stopping it from replicating. But the second thing that multi-drug therapy does is actually prevent these resistant strains, because if the organism is able to mutate such that one drug is no longer effective, the other two will get it. And so especially for some of these faster evolving organisms, it's incredibly crucial that you have to treat it with multi-drug therapy so that you don't you aren't able to create the conditions that resistant strain can grow. And this is actually sort of the same concept as they're going for here. But if they were looking at one conserved spot that didn't have very often mutations that they could sort of be relatively sure would be there, then yes, you would absolutely select for those viruses that had that specific, if rare, mutation. However, by attacking an incredible number of sites, then the probability of that goes right through the floor.
And, you know, you see a lot of these articles in the news about sort of breakthroughs in medicine or treatment of some virus or something. And it's always sort of if, maybe, then, possibly, maybe. But this one seemed a bit more sure of itself. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think this is closer than others and actually becoming viable in use?
Well, there are some major issues as far as clinical trials for HIV that stem not only from the medical side, but also from the policy side. So conducting human trials of HIV vaccines are really, really contentious because, of course, any good clinical trial involves a placebo, which means that you're giving someone therapy that could be working or not working. And yes, all of the test subjects are absolutely informed of this, but there are people that make bad decisions based on a chance. And so there are a lot of people that get up in arms, and doing these trials is quite difficult. Also, you have to be absolutely sure and have enormous sample sizes and long study times, because a vaccine for HIV that's 80% effective could actually be more detrimental to society than no vaccine at all. So you really have to be sure of the efficacy of what you're doing so that people don't take unnecessary risk-taking behavior. What I found really, really cool about this study was that the exact area that they're looking at is actually found in people that are naturally, sort of protective, super protective against HIV and can have the virus but don't get sick. Their immune systems target the exact same part of the virus. So not only is this sort of theoretical laboratory in vitro work, it's been bearing out in the real world.
Just one, sorry, because we've had this discussion in another area. I thought with vaccines, they actually don't use a placebo. They use sort of the current treatment versus the new treatment because of the ethical issues. So, for example, with flu vaccines, they, one of the criticisms that's always been used is that we don't use properly controlled studies because no one ever gets a placebo in the flu because that's unethical. So wouldn't they follow the same sort of procedure in this where you would have...
What current vaccine could you use for HIV?
No, well, the drug cocktail, for example, versus...
That's for treatment, not prevention.
Okay.
I'm not totally up on it, but there was definitely some controversies when there was human trials going on a few years ago. I don't remember the exact details, so it was probably about 7 years ago, and they thought that it was going to phase three, but it didn't pass. And I remember they were doing trials in Vancouver, and it was a major issue because of that. There might be something else that they give them, but considering the fact that we don't actually have anything that's effective in preventing HIV, I'm having trouble imagining what that might be.
So why would there be an ethical concern? I mean, if you don't have a vaccine, you could have a pure placebo group.
Right. Okay. But that poses the problem where if people think 50-50, meh, that's good enough. Sure, I'll have unprotected sex or shoot up with a potentially infected needle.
No, I do. But less than 50-50.
Okay, well, that was a fascinating conversation. Let's go to a commercial break. And when we come back, we'll hear from Deidre, who's going to be telling us a bit about a new New York law about same-sex marriage. Stay tuned.
Why, sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all in a fire.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh, yeah.
Hey there, this is Deidre on Radio Freethinker. As some of you may have heard, last Friday, the American gay rights movement experienced a major success as the Senate passed with a 33-29 vote legislation to legalize same-sex marriage in the state of New York. This is a pivotal and historical moment in the struggle for marriage equality, as this win doubles the amount of people living in a state where sexual minorities have the freedom to marry whom they choose. It is possible that this could be the tipping point the movement has been waiting for to usher in freedom nationally. Amongst the 33 of those who voted yes were four Republican senators, of which justified their decisions by saying that either they could make no argument for why same-sex marriage should be illegal, or that they felt it was the right thing to do. Senator Roy McDonald, who voted no in the last attempt to legalize same-sex marriage in New York, created a major buzz in the media as he said, "You get to the point where you evolve in your life where everything isn't black and white, good and bad, and you try to do the right thing. You might not like that. You might be very cynical about that. Well, bleep it. I don't care what you think. I'm trying to do the right thing. I'm tired of Republican-Democrat politics. They can take the job and shove it. I come from a blue-collar background. I'm trying to do the right thing, and that's where I'm going with this." Well, of course, this win doesn't come without controversy. The religious right sees this as a major loss and attack on their religious freedom. The job of protecting religious freedom while granting full marriage equality to all, it's been a pretty hard task in the United States. But this is also a big win for secularism and humanism. Seeing Republicans take a stand and do what is right for the common good is a really exciting aspect. rather than choosing to uphold partisan politics or make faith-based decisions that affect the entire population. Previously, firm gay marriage opponents are stepping up to the plate. One of the largest nonprofit faith-based organizations that lobbied to prevent marriage equality legislation from passing is the National Organization for Marriage. Last summer, the campaign toured through America holding rallies and events for their cause. The bus driver on the Summer for Marriage tour was Louis Marinelli, a man who until recently actually had his own campaign called Protect Marriage, One Man, One Woman, which on its Facebook page has over 250,000 fans. Recently, Louis Marinelli pulled a 360 on his supporters by announcing his newly found full support for marriage equality. This was because during the tour last summer, he met individuals from a pro-marriage equality campaign following the rallies and began to understand the damage of his pursuit. He was quoted as saying, "I realized that my work wasn't affecting faceless, nameless political targets, but instead good people." It's pretty exciting to hear about things like this, to hear how people are actually connecting how the cause and effect of their actions. I think it's going to be really exciting to see what happens in the upcoming years for the gay rights movement and with the struggle to keep politics secular in the United States. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Deidre. So she brought up some interesting questions. I thought it was interesting how the laws provide an out for religious organizations to not perform same-sex marriage, which I think is interesting because it basically enshrines in law their homophobia for everyone to see in the next 20 or so years when everyone else realizes this is just a matter of, you know, human dignity and liberty and not a religious issue.
Well, I think you get actually an interesting sort of dichotomy here. First of all, I think the person that Deidre was referring to did a 180, not a 360. If they do a 360, they're going back the same way they were coming originally. So that being said, the whole institution of marriage, to me, I have some issues with because, again, I see this form of property ownership, right? And although I think everyone should be equal to get married, I mean, that if someone has a right to be married, everyone should have a right to be married. I think that's true, although I myself would probably abolish the whole institution of marriage. Civil unions, that sort of contract thing, it seems much more appropriate in this. But I don't like the idea of them being able to dictate to me what I can and cannot do. And this becomes a certain area where I'm not sure if I feel 100% comfortable forcing them to do something that they don't want to do. Now, I think if the only way you could get married in our society was through a church, through a synagogue or something like that, then most definitely they would have to perform it irrespective. But I don't see where it would be right to force a Catholic priest to marry a Muslim and a Jew. I mean, you know, like if that goes against, he says, this is the Roman Catholic Church. We only marry Roman Catholic people here. Again, I would abolish the church altogether. That would be my solution to the problem. But until we're ready to take that positive step, I don't know. I don't like the fact that it is implicitly reinforcing homophobia, but at the same time, I'm not 100% comfortable in forcing them to, provided they are private, separate, and not necessary aspects of society.
Right. And the sort of non-religious side of things, like businesses and organizations, have to follow the law. They can't discriminate. They can't just say, oh, I don't like gay people, so I'm not going to, you know, rent my hall or my banquet space to this couple.
Exactly. And I mean, hiring practices. I mean, one of the areas where this comes into direct conflict, which we had here recently, I think it was with the a lesbian who gave birth to a child or something, and she posted on a thing. She was a teacher at a Catholic school. I think I'm probably misremembering some of the details. And they essentially fired her for that. Now, that's where I think you've kind of crossed the line where, you know, you are sort of providing a public service. A school is a public service. And at which point, then, you can't discriminate someone based on their sexual orientations.
Right. Well, let's go to a commercial. When we come back, we'll have Ben Radford talking about paranormal investigation. Stay tuned on Radio Free Thinker.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker, we have Benjamin Radford, paranormal investigator and managing editor of Skeptical Inquirer. Welcome, Ben, to the show.
Well, thank you. Good to be on.
So tell us a bit about your past. You are now a paranormal investigator, but how did you become a paranormal investigator?
Well, it really began probably in the 80s when I was a teenager, and I would pick up books on the paranormal and the strange and mysterious and the unexplained and all that. And I was fascinated by them. I mean, I was like, oh, this is cool, you know, astrology and runes and Bermuda Triangle and monsters and UFOs and stuff. But I was kind of disappointed when I would read these books, because they really only told stories. They didn't tell investigations. And I recognized that most of the books that I was reading were well intentioned, and there some of them were even well written, but the majority of them were just repeating stories. There was nobody actively searching and no one actively investigating. And so I determined that I was interested in these subjects, and I wanted to know more about them, but I wanted to know the details. I wanted to know, you know, how do we know that? Who said that? If you're telling me that you know that one person's sun sign, astrology sign, says, you know, well, this person must be especially empathetic or helpful or jealous or something. How do you know that? Who said this? And so, I kept asking those questions, and I didn't find the answers in the books that I had. And so, one day I picked up a copy of Skeptical Inquirer magazine, of which I'm now the managing editor of, and I saw a piece by James Randi on Nostradamus, and I'd heard of Nostradamus. I mean, it was, you know, the great seer, you know, French seer. He foretold this and that and the other. And what I found interesting was that Randi's analysis was the first time that I'd ever seen anybody challenge the given view of Nostradamus as a man of prophecy and a man who knew the future and this and that. And Randi's piece really laid it out for me, saying, look, you know, these are written in old French. This is not an easy language to translate, and certainly archaic even back then. And not only was it archaic, but it was ambiguous. It was hard to know what exactly the person meant. And when I saw sort of a more skeptical, another side of the story, I said, well, hold on, I want to do that. I'm interested in that. So that's basically where I went from there.
And you've recently been researching the Chupacabra. Mm-hmm. What made you interested in this relatively new monster?
Yeah, well, there were a couple things that struck me about the Chupacabra, you know, the goat sucker in Spanish. And it's a couple things that intrigued me. One was that it's a monster known around the world. It's, you know, it's probably the world's second best known vampire after Dracula, and it's certainly the world's third best known creature after Bigfoot and Nessie. And yet it's of relatively recent vintage. Unlike Bigfoot and Nessie, there aren't really claims that it was seen back by the natives, you know, and, you know, hundreds of years ago people knew it as blah blah blah. And so it's a relatively recent monster, and And of course, you know, part of it was that it's a vampire, and that's intriguing because, you know, it sucks blood. You know, Bigfoot doesn't suck blood, Nessie doesn't suck blood, Mothman doesn't suck blood. So even within the realm of monsters in cryptozoology, it's a unique creature because it's so new, because it's a vampire. And so those were things that really, and I think part of it was that I felt an in with it because I live in New Mexico and there'd actually been a couple New Mexico related sightings and reports, and I speak Spanish, and so it was sort of a natural thing that I could sort of sink my teeth into, if you will, and go after it. And the biggest thing was that it's because it was such a recent monster, I felt that I had at least the chance of definitively solving it. You know, unlike Bigfoot, I mean, there's so much to Bigfoot. I mean, I know a lot about Bigfoot and I've written about Bigfoot, but I don't think I could claim to have definitively so-called solved the Bigfoot mystery. There's too many sightings, some of them have been proven hoaxes. It's such a massive subject. There's so many sightings, so many reports. Not necessarily good quality evidence, mind you, but just the sheer quantity of all that, and same thing with Loch Ness Monster. But in the case of Chupacabra, I felt that I had a shot at definitively solving the mystery if I put in the time and the effort and I sort of piece it together. And so that's what I tried to do. And in the course of it, you know, I went to Nicaragua. I spent some time looking for it in the jungles of Nicaragua near the Costa Rican border. I went to Texas for a TV show called Monster Quest. I went to Puerto Rico and interviewed the original eyewitness. So I did a lot of field research and like on-the-ground work.
Did researching the Chupacabra give you an idea of how these monster myths evolve over time? And you mentioned this is really new. So, and the original sighting was quite a bit different from sort of the kind of dog version that we have now.
Right.
Originally, it was kind of this alien-like creature with spines on its back and had all this mystical powers.
Mm-hmm.
So did it give you a new perspective on how a monster myth can evolve in a really short period of time just by eyewitness accounts? And
yeah, it's. I mean, that was one of the most interesting things about it was that if you look at it, the Chupacabra essentially appears in two main forms. The original form is a spiky-backed sort of alien-esque creature that's 3 to 5 feet tall, has sort of alien wraparound eyes, spikes down the back, long, thin arms and legs, no tail. Some people say it has wings. And this was like the original type that was sighted in Puerto Rico in 1995, 1996, and a little bit after that. And this was sighted and reported in various places, primarily in Latin America, but elsewhere as well. But by about 2000, no one saw it anymore. It was gone. It just vanished. And There was a lull of a couple years, and then right around the mid-2000s, another type of chupacabra emerged. This one emerged in the American Southwest, primarily in Texas and a little bit in New Mexico. And this was a very different chupacabra. This was a completely different chupacabra. These were hairless or nearly hairless canids, that is, members of a family that includes dogs, coyotes, foxes, things like that. And they typically had sort of, you know, large, scary-looking teeth, almost no hair. But other than that, they looked like, you know, shaved dogs, essentially. The problem, of course, was that these are two completely irreconcilably different monsters. The bipedal, spiky-backed creature with the alien-esque eyes cannot be the same thing as these dead dogs that they're finding in Texas. They're not the same thing. And yet, both of them in the public's consciousness were being called the Chupacabra. And of course, mixed in with all this were the creatures that had been supposedly drained of blood, the dogs and coyotes and goats primarily, of course, and chickens and cats and domestic animals as well. So this was all thrown into the mix. And so so one thing that really intrigued me about it was that there were these disparate forms of the Chupacabra, and what you find is that actually the idea of what a Chupacabra is began as a very, very specific creature. I mean, if you ask someone in Chupacabra, if you ask somebody in late 1996, what does a Chupacabra look like, you get a very specific answer. These days, it's basically anything weird. mm-hmm. you know, everything from a diseased canid to a bipedal monster. So there's a wide variety. So you have this broadening of the cultural definition of the chupacabra, and in the case of the chupacabra, there's a very interesting cultural aspect to it and social aspect to it. And it involves conspiracy theories. It involves UFOs and extraterrestrials. It involves the sensationalizing media, the tabloids and gossip and rumor and urban legend and folklore. So there are lots of really interesting elements to it that sort of combine to essentially create the chupacabra over the last 15 years.
I did some research on the chupacabra myself a little while ago, and I noticed that a lot of the sources that I could find were written by you in articles with both Skeptical Inquirer and such. And I remember reading that one of the first eyewitnesses had recently seen a science fiction movie, mm-hmm. and that the monster in the movie very closely resembled the chupacabra they described. Mm-hmm. Is it any coincidence that they happened to see this sci-fi movie and then spotted the monster?
Well, it's either one of the most remarkable coincidences in history, or it's no coincidence at all. My analysis is that what the most famous eyewitness saw, a woman named Madeline Tolentino, who lived in Canovanas, in a suburb of San Juan, Puerto Rico, in August of 95, was almost certainly taken directly from a film that she saw, a film called Species. And in fact, she admitted this. I interviewed her as well, and I actually dug up an interview that was done in 1996, shortly after the chupacabra had become a global phenomenon, but was in the process of doing so. And she says quite clearly, I saw this movie, and the chupacabra looked a lot like this creature. And to me, that was one of the smoking guns. Like, well, hold on here. Hold on here. How likely is it that the chupacabra that you saw just happens to look almost exactly like this monster in this film? Or is it more likely that there was a cause and effect relationship instead of just a wild coincidence? And with that piece of the puzzle together, that essentially solves the origin of the chupacabra, because again, the chupacabra essentially did not exist prior to 1995. There's a bird called the chupacabra, and there's little variations, but there was no, in 1995, as far as I can tell, all the evidence suggests this, that there was no creature, no blood-sucking creature in Puerto Rico or anywhere else in the world that was called the chupacabra that had the characteristics that we now associate with the chupacabra. Because it appeared at such a very specific time in history, and certainly in Puerto Rican cultural history and social history, that's where it came from. And there you go. I guess somebody who wanted to challenge my assumptions on that, the problem, they could claim that it's just a remarkable coincidence. But again, even their own eyewitness says it's, I'm not making this up. That's what she's on the record as saying that. So because of the research that I did into it, I think I've pretty well definitively solved this mystery. Which it's interesting because in the scientific paranormal investigation that I do, it's fairly rare to be able to so definitively solve a mystery. I'm not just patting myself on the back. I mean, just historically, there's very few occasions where there's a phenomenon that's globally known around the world that through good, careful, skeptical analysis can essentially say, look, this is it. This is the totality of what this is.
And you mentioned earlier in your lecture and also the workshop you did today in Vancouver about establishing a written scholarly database for future mm-hmm. People to look at.
Right.
Do you think maybe in 10, 20 years, when we encounter monster myth, we'll be able to refer back to the work that you've done, that people like Joe Nickel have done, and Skeptical Inquirer in your books, and have a methodology for investigating these monster mysteries, and perhaps will we see a decline in monster mysteries because of this?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I think that skepticism as a movement and as an effort will be successful to the degree to which it models the sciences and essentially science being an accumulation of knowledge, A person studies this. This is what they found, and future researchers, investigators, and people can look back and say, look, you know, here's this modern mystery, whether it's a ghost or a monster or whatever else. And when they see these things in the future, they can say, well, hold on here. I mean, this is similar to that thing that, you know, that Radford investigated in 2010 or Joe Nickell investigated in 1996 or what have you. And that can help not only solve mysteries, but help provide a context for other people to solve mysteries. And certainly it provides a context by which we can understand unusual phenomena. And even if these things are not real, even if Bigfoot is not real, even if psychic powers do not exist, even if ghosts do not exist, even if these things aren't really out there, it's important to understand what people thought were the chupacabra, what people thought were ghosts, what people thought were psychic powers, what people mistook for alien crop circles. Because it tells you, you know, if you basically, you know, disproving something that people thought was X is often just as important, if not more so, than proving X, because it helps separate the wheat from the chaff. It helps people understand, you know, this is what they thought, and this is why we now know that this isn't real. So that's my hope. I mean, in terms of the question of, you know, will people continue to see monsters? Almost certainly. People have, you know, I think it's almost inherent in human nature. People like the idea of monsters and Bigfoot and aliens and people, you know, alien brothers watching us from above and all that. So, you know, people have talked about dragons and unicorns and fairies and elves and gremlins, and, you know, it's an important, you know, cultural and fictional aspect of many cultures. And so that's not going to go away. And I suspect that we will always have monsters with us. And I would suggest that in some ways that's fine. You know, it's kind of cool to think there's a monster in Loch Ness. It's kind of neat to think there's, you know, a Bigfoot out there, that there's a chupacabra that's waiting to pounce on a goat tomorrow night. But you have to separate that out from the reality, from saying, okay, this is a neat idea, this is kind of cool, this is a fun story, and you can appreciate it as such. Or if you want, because of the research that I've done, other people have done, in other cases, you can look at it, you can say, look, this is what this is. This is not real. We know it's not real, and this is why. And again, in the future, when people are looking at similar mysteries, they can sort of look back on the published record and say, this was done.
Excellent. Well, before we wrap up here, tell us, Ben, what's your favorite ghost story, monster movie, favorite tale of the supernatural?
Favorite tale of the supernatural? Well, I have a couple. I would say probably one of is. I'll give you two ones just to cheat. One of them would be the Vanishing Hitchhiker story, the urban legend of, you know, the couple that, you know, meets a poor freezing girl on a lonely highway, and she says, you know, can I give you a ride? And so she says, yeah, come on in. The hitchhiker takes a ride, and she sits in the back, and she's cold and shivering, and she sometimes has a shawl or something over her, and they're talking, you know, do you live around here? Oh, yeah, I live just down the road. Can you take me to my parents' house? And they say, oh, no problem, we'll take you there. So they drive a little bit further on, and they see a farmhouse, and that was described by the girl, and they pull in. And as they're pulling in, they turn around and say, okay, we're here. Here's your house. And she's gone. And I won't tell you the rest of the story if you don't know it, but that's one of my favorite Vanishing Hitchhiker stories. And then the other one would probably be the organ-snatching urban legend, the kidney theft. Mm-hmm. I've researched that quite a bit and written about that. You know, it's a story of where, you know, a guy meets an attractive young lady in a bar, either in Brazil or some other South American or other, you know, other country or city, and you know, they go up to his hotel room, and he wakes up the next morning with a kidney gone in a tub of ice, and there's a big note scrawled on the mirror saying, "Call 911, your kidney's gone," and oh my God, kidney theft! So those are probably two of my favorites.
Excellent. Well, Ben, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker. Keep up the great work investigating the paranormal, and let us know if you find something, because we're very interested in that kind of stuff here.
I will do so. I'll let you know if I find things, and I will let you know if I don't find things.
BC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Welcome back to Radio Freethinker. Our thanks to Ben Radford for the interview. We're out of time, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. Jenna?
So mine isn't so much a skeptical highlight necessarily as a really interesting and thought-provoking science highlight. So this is a book called The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Doidge, and I just love this book. It's a compilation of studies that are really breaking down the common misconception that our brains are static and can't really grow or change as we're adults. So a quick warning, just if you're enormous on animal rights, this book might not be right for you. Sometimes to make an omelet, you have to stitch a few monkeys.
Yes, with that classic segue. As many, many of our listeners obviously know, this is International Year of Chemistry. And as part of that, the International Year of Chemistry Society is doing what's called the Global Water Experiment. School students around the world are invited to help explore one of the world's most crucial resources, water. They propose as part of this experiment that classes from around the world go out and actually take some measurements. One of the things about climate change and all that is we don't actually have a good global measure of some important things like acidity, salinity, water purity, that sort of thing. So the idea is to get a bunch of school kids to go out, because you don't have to pay them, and to do all these sort of experiments from around the world and correlate the data in one central location. If you happen to be a teacher or a student or something like that and you would like to participate, go to water.chemistry2011.org and you can find the link there. There'll be one on our website. And it could be lots of fun for our younger listeners or for our more academically astute people who might teach younger people or something.
Sounds good. My skeptical highlight is Vancouver Skeptic Camp 2011. It's coming up on August 6th. It's an all-day open conference from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Come on out and hear local skeptics give talks on all kinds of things like critical thinking and science. They give presentations, perform demonstrations, and it's a nice way to have group discussions with a very friendly skeptical audience. We encourage everybody to participate, and we are currently looking for speakers. So if you'd like to give a talk at Skeptic Camp, let us know. You can email me at eclow@cficanada.ca, and we want all kinds of people. If your talk is on critical thinking or skepticism, let us know. We'd love to have you give a talk for our fifth Skeptic Camp here in Vancouver. Well, we're out of time here on Radio Freethinker, so this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Jenna saying, remember, the real world is amazing.
That's very important.
I'm skeptical of that.
No, you're not. So long, everybody. Become a friend.